A senseless demand that one see beautiful things, therefore money should be spent for decorating the temples and the compounds. Takes good food which should be bought and offered to the deity. The nose may utilize the smelling power to offer the deity, hearing can utilize the listening to the vibration of the Hare Krishna. Mahamantra, this way the senses can be regulated and utilized to advance Krishna consciousness. Thus, the position might not be spoiled by material sense gratification, the possible of success, beauty, and constitution of family. One spoils an opulent position of material by driving cars, spending time in nightclubs, or tasting abominable food in restaurants. In these ways, the plundering senses take away all the assets that the conditioned soul is acquired with great difficulty. Translation: the force of material existence, the uncontrolled senses, are like plunder to the conditioned soul. May earn some money for the advancement of Krishna consciousness, but the force of the uncontrolled senses plunder as money through sense gratification. Senses are plunged because they make one spend his money unnecessarily for seeing, smelling, tasting, touching, hearing, desiring, and willing. In this way, the conditioned soul is obliged to gratify the senses and thus all his money is spent. This money is actually acquired for the execution of religious principles, but it is taken away by the plundering senses. So in the previous chapter, the merchant went into the forest, and there were various thieves ready to take things away from him. If he got some wealth, then the thieves will come and take it away. So here is explained that those thieves are actually not some external factor, like other people or weather conditions or sickness or whatever, but actually it is his own senses. His senses act as thieves in the sense that because of his senses, which are attracted to things in this material world, whatever wealth he attains, he has to spend it in order to get those things that the sense have a desire for. In the Bhagavad Gita, we have an analysis of the different stages. First one meditates on objects of the senses, and one develops attachment to them. Then one must get those things. So normally in the material world, to get things, we have to put forth effort, or we have to spend money. And to get the money, of course, then we have to put more effort. So in this way, because of our senses being attracted to sense objects, we have to spend money in the material world to get those objects. And if we don't get them, then we become angry, etc. So problem with our endeavors in the material world is that the senses never stop their desires for enjoying sense objects. Therefore, we must continually supply objects, and to do that, we must continually get money in order to satisfy the senses. So we have 10 senses, 5 knowledge gathering senses and 5 working senses. And together they develop attractions and also means of getting those particular objects. But in any case, we have to put forth a lot of effort. So the living entity is described as the merchant who is looking for wealth. A merchant is a vaishya. A vaishya is one who likes to collect money and then, of course, enjoy it. So this is the nature, the normal nature of the jiva in the material world. And then he must continually collect because the senses continually become attracted to objects. They want things. So this is compared here to the man in the forest getting robbed by different thieves. So the thieves gradually take away all of his wealth that he earned. So actually the thieves are not outside. There may be thieves, of course, but here the thieves represent his own senses. Even if no one else steals from him, he must spend his money because his senses are uncontrolled. So the solution to this is to control the senses. As Krishna also says in Bhagavad Gita concerning kama, kama is dwelling in the senses and the mind and the intelligence. And we have to be controlling. So therefore Krishna says, first you control the senses. So somehow or other we have to limit the senses, and this way we can stop the plundering. If we stop the plundering, then we don't have to work so hard to gather our wealth, because we can save the wealth and not spend it. And maybe use it for good causes. So the problem with controlling the senses is we cannot control the senses unless we control the mind. And Arjuna says, oh, the mind is very difficult to control. So Krishna also says this thing, that yes, very difficult to control the mind and the senses and whatever. Nevertheless, Krishna also says you have to try. Abhyasena, you have to practice repetition. Attempts must be made to control the mind, control the senses. So the of course, the senses don't like that in one sense because they want to enjoy it. So to limit that enjoyment is some sort of restriction, which is uncomfortable. So the only possible way in which we can get that control is if there is higher taste. Higher taste for the senses and the mind and intelligence, then we can control the senses. So that higher taste, of course, could be material. You develop have a tamagun taste, you turn into rajagun taste or a sattvagun taste, and in this way we can control somewhat by altering the gunas. When one comes to sattvagun taste, then of course the interesting thing there is sattvagun means lack of or less attraction or enjoyment of the senses. And the reason is that one becomes satisfied with the self. So that is where the higher taste takes place in sattva-guna, where one begins to understand that one is not the body, and that real happiness and satisfaction is understanding one is not one instead of body. And consequently, one has less attraction for material things. So higher taste means gradually shifting one's attention to the Atma rather than to the material body. This, of course, was the intention of Japara in speaking to the king. This whole allegory of the forest and the man in the forest is to give King Rahula the realization that he's not the body at all, but he's the Atma. And this attempt to try to satisfy the material body and the senses is actually useless. This is the, we could say, the first stage of sense control. So this is instituted in the Varnashram system, where there are rules of control, and there's certain things you can do and certain things you can't do. Certain things you can do also, those things are sense gratification, but that's limited because certain types of sense gratification you cannot do. So there are restrictions on the senses within that system. Of course, within any society, we do have sets of rules and regulations and laws of the country. And if you don't follow the laws, you get put in jail. The problem is that there's no real goal other than to keep an orderly society. Whereas in the Varnashram system, the goal is to change your gunas and gradually elevate you through tamagun to rajagun to sattvagun. This is the goal. By regulating the senses, gradually you end up with sattvagun. That is not the goal in the Western society, the laws of the country. It's not to bring it to sattvagun at all. Keep a minimal order in society so not everybody can enjoy as much as they can with at the same time maintaining an economy. That basically, that's what it is. Whereas in the Varnashram system, the higher you go, the less sense gratification you get. in one sense. But that doesn't mean you don't enjoy it, because it becomes a sattva guna, then you develop your spiritual taste and spiritual enjoyment. So that is the difference between the varnashram system and a normal social system. And the goal is different, even though the rules may look similar. So, that is one step in getting the higher taste. The other step is, the higher taste, of course, is to directly develop the satisfaction of bliss of the Atma by engaging it in devotional service. That is a little more direct. Simply to understand one is not the body, one is the Atma, and enjoy the self, that's jnana. But higher than that is to engage the Atma and consequently the material body and the mind and intelligence in serving the Supreme Lord. That produces, not this Atma again, that actually produces a happiness related to bhakti. Simply by doing bhakti, the soul becomes contented. When one reaches bhava and prema, that turns into ananda or bliss, spiritual bliss, emanating from the Vladini Shakti of the Lord. And when the jiva gets that experience, then that higher taste completely eradicates any taste for the material world. Or even liberation. So that is why a person in the stage of bhava, having experienced a little bit of ananda of the Lord, rejects liberation as well as any enjoyment of the material world. And when he takes prema, that ananda becomes most intense, and therefore there's no question of him ever falling into maya once he's in that stage of prema. So there again, taste is important, but the taste is not simply understanding one as Atma and peaceful, etc., but it is the bliss of serving the Supreme Lord. That taste, that ananda, is even stronger than the taste of Atma. So that is why Krishna recommends the process of bhakti over jnana and yoga as a practical process, because the taste is much sweeter. And therefore, the jiva can more easily detach himself from everything in the material world. So Prabhupada here in the purport mentions, we can engage the various senses in the service of the Lord. When that is done with the favorable inclinations of the Atma itself, Anupali and Krishna Vasilam, then it becomes bhakti. If we don't have that favorable feeling for the Lord and we do these activities, we don't call that bhakti. It may be accidental engagement, but if we don't call that bhakti. So only after faith arrives and one is favorable to the Lord, that is the ahana levels and favorable to the Lord, then the engagement of the senses and the mind becomes bhakti at that stage. So that is the stage of sadhana bhakti, where we, with discipline, engage the mind and senses in serving the Supreme Lord with that favorable attitude and desire to please the Lord. And so that gives rise to a feeling of sukha, or happiness, spiritual happiness, greater than the happiness of Atmagyan and realizing one is Atman rather than body. So that is mentioned as subhada, or bestowal of auspiciousness, the second quality of bhakti. One develops sukha, or a happiness, which is superior to the happiness of liberation or the happiness of material enjoyment of the world. So, in order to stop this plundering of the senses taking away all the wealth and spending on different things, the best process is to engage in bhakti. And then, when engaging the senses, etc., in that process, instead of spending the money for enjoyment of the senses, we will spend the money for devotional service, things involved in devotion rather than things involved in sense gratification. So we spend the money in order to do things to please the Lord. And in doing so, this is a type of engagement of bhakti that does not create karma, rather destroys all karma. So this is the practical way of controlling these ponderous different senses.
How can we get the human that devotional service is also a sort of sense?
It's for the pleasure of the Lord.
That the devotee understands, but some others may not accept that it is. We are just making sense in there, just like others.
Well, they will have to develop faith. You cannot preach to the faithless person if they have a skepticism with religion.
In the course of Sanam Bhakti, we do most of the activities only for our purification rather than for pleasing the Lord.
Pardon?
In the Sanam Bhakti, most of the activities we do for purifying ourselves rather than pleasing
the Lord. Well, the definition is Anukulena Krishna Anusilana, to cultivate a relation of Krishna with the desire to please Him. So there's no mention there of purifying ourselves. So if that is the main goal, that would be something like Yamas or Bhakti. Purification is the result, but it's not the goal. That's more for liberation.
Many times we hear the statement, purity is the force, so we have to purify ourselves by a good sadhana and other things, then only we have to do activities.
Yeah. No, purity is the result of the bhakti itself. Well, yes, it is a result, but it's not the goal. That's also a secondary result. Higher than purity is devotion. But purity is a result of devotion also. In other words, liberation and whatever is also a result of bhakti, but it's not the goal. If you're liberated, you are pure in one sense. In other words, there's no more gunas left in liberation. And material science of the mind brain is connected with the senses of neurons. And spiritual science approaches the mind senses through pranas. Well, the subtle body. In physical science, we only have a brain, and out of that, then, and that means the mind, etc. However, some scientists, I think even Penrose and others, understand or admit that the mind is not the brain. It's not synonymous with it. It's an independent entity. And one cannot explain why, when people are brain dead, they can have experiences and come back to life again. It is impossible to explain that by the neurons in the brain which are not operating. So, therefore, we cannot say the mind and the brain are synonymous. There's something different. So, in the Vedic literature, we find that the mind actually is a subtle element. The brain is not a subtle element, it is a gross element. And it's not even mentioned as a sense or anything of the analysis of material elements. We have all the senses there, but we don't have the brain. But we have the mind. That doesn't mean that the Vedas don't recognize their brain is there, obviously. It's like a heart and some of the other things are there. But the real, more important than the brain is the mind function, which is invisible, which is part of the subtle body. The mind, intelligence, ego, etc. are all part of the subtle body along with the pranas. So they connect with the gross body in many ways. Pranas help with that. Not the only thing, but they're one factor involved. On the lower level, the pranas are first aspect of the subtle body. So they are the grosser part of the subtle body, because they're not actually a subtle element. They're actually pranas are made out of vayu, which is an element, a gross element. Mind actually is higher than that. It's a higher element.
What are the information gathered from mind to the senses? Senses are gross.
Well, we don't say the brain is not involved. Definitely, it is involved. Scientifically, you can prove that, I suppose. But we say that's not the only way in which there's connections. And the senses themselves also are not these senses. When they talk about the eye, the ear, the nose, and the literatures, those senses
are elements, which are different from these senses, which are made out of gross elements. So there's a distinction between the gross material sense and the subtle sense, which goes with the subtle body, from body to body. So you have two sets of senses, as well as two minds, the brain mind and the mind mind, and you have the subtle sense and the gross sense. So you've got a whole other body there, made out of these other things, which interacts, of course, with the gross senses and the gross brain, etc.
So when the mind shuts off, the sense isn't bothered.
Huh?
So the mind is completely shut off. The senses do not work. Somebody's crazy or brain dead.
No, well, the subtle senses can work in any case. The brain may be dead, but the mind and the senses can still operate separately. So the subtle body can proceed separately from the gross body under certain conditions. Usually we don't do that, but one can. And even in a dream state, in a sense, one uses the subtle senses and not the gross senses. And the subtle mind and not the gross mind, whatever. So the two things usually we cannot see the difference, but when we near-death experience, for instance, they are separated. And we do have the subtle body with the subtle senses and the mind operate independently of the gross body and the gross senses and the gross brain.
So the chanting one can even chant mentally, so that you can chant loudly, and then the gross body is so someone can say, I can chant mentally and directly connect to the subtle body.
Well, yeah, both are there. Of course, the gross sound is one thing, but within that we should understand there is the subtle sound and the spiritual sound. Sound itself has four elements, para, madhyama, prasanti, and vaikari. Vaikari is what we hear, that sound, but then there's three other subtle levels, and para is the spiritual level. So there's a spiritual sound covered up by various material coverings, and it becomes more and more gross until we hear it through, let's say, material ear or whatever in our eardrum. That's the grossest aspect of sound. But beneath that, of course, is that subtle spiritual sound also. And that sound cannot be heard by the material ear or even the subtle ear. It has to actually be heard by the Atma and his senses.
I heard from the way saying that there are a lot of things happening in the mind. Chant loudly so that you won't hear the chant as loud as possible so that you don't hear the body meditating.
Yeah, that's one way of concentrating is to use sound. So the sound, of course, as I said, has the aspect of material sound, but then within that is the spiritual sound. So we can attract the mind with loud sound, but then that is the spiritual sound as well. So there's no problem because one still develops spiritually by that.
That is
simply
not a gimmick. It's not thinking that I chant loudly to keep away my mind from thinking. That is simply continuous daily, even that.
Well, if he does it mechanically with no devotion, then it's not bhakti. Certainly the name itself, like an Ajamil chants without bhakti, it also works, but it's a very slow process then. And if we do it with devotion, then it's a very quick process. Yeah, the attempt is not purification, the attempt is to develop devotion. If we are to develop devotion, then purification automatically takes place. So therefore, Kleshagni and Subhada, these are byproducts that manifest in sadhana bhakti. That is, all material sufferings disappear, which means all karmas, all desires, etc., and gunas, etc., get destroyed through the process of bhakti, but that's not the goal, those are symptoms of it. So if we concentrate on the goal, the symptom becoming the goal, then we get a partial partial effect of bhakti. We don't get the goal, we get the symptom. Huh? So we go through one little stage.
Huh? But some devotees say that purification is a process for getting devotion.
Hmm?
Purification is a process for getting devotion.
What
does that mean? Unless and until we get purified.
You can't do devotion without being pure. So in that case, nobody can do bhakti. Because nobody's pure.
Prabhupada gives an example of the burning house. The house is burning. They just come out of the house.
No, so anyone in any condition, tamagun, rajagun, sattvagun, we have to start somewhere, which is impure in any case. So we have to start somewhere, and in bhakti, anybody in any guna is qualified to start the process. In jnana, no, you have to be sattvagun. Of course, that's not pure also, it's relatively pure, but it's still material.
Definitely,
you
are pure, that's the other
blessing. Hmm?
Proportional. So
no.
Somebody is pure, he
teaches.
Immediately.
But what is that pure? Is that bhakti or pure? Is he sattva gun pure? If he's sattva gun pure, then he may turn into vayavani or whatever by that sattva gun mentality, or may become charitable instead. So, purity, and I think we mix up purity with devotion. The devotion creates purity, definitely. But if one is attracted to the purity aspect rather than the devotional aspect of a person, then one may be ultimately attracted to the wrong thing.
Yantra Sri Srimad Bhagavatam ki
jai.
Dolan Brahmaraj ki
jai.
Dwayne Vedis Bhakti Sankara Prabhupada ki
jai.
Dai Gopramanam Devi.